Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist and former Australian Treasury official. The aim of this show is to help you better understand the big economic issues affecting all our lives. We do this by considering the theory, evidence, and by hearing a wide range of views. I'm delighted that you can join me for this episode. Please check out the show notes for relevant information. Now on to the show. Hello and welcome to the show. In this episode, we're taking a closer look at the Australian government's recent economic reform roundtable in August 2025. Officially, the event was supposed to generate bold ideas for boosting productivity. But many observers, including the people you hear from this episode, found it lacking in focus, with too few voices from business and innovative sectors at the table. To unpack what really happened, I joined Damien Currie, host of The Other Side, Graham Young from the Australian Institute for Progress, and former Bloomberg editor and data analyst Dan Petrie. We had a wide-ranging roundtable discussion of our own. I've borrowed the audio for this episode from the YouTube video of the conversation featured in the Other Side episode from August 22nd. If you want to watch the video version, you can find the link in the show notes. Together, Damien, Dan, Graham and I explore the big issues the government largely avoided at its roundtable. These issues include Australia's high energy costs and the heavy burden of government spending. We also consider the role of unions in shaping policies on productivity and AI. I should add that, while the official summit was happening in Canberra, I attended a rival roundtable, which was held directly upstairs in Parliament House above the Cabinet Room where the official roundtable was occurring. It was convened by friend of the show, Senator Matt Canavan. Matt's gathering brought together figures like Gary Banks, the former head of the Productivity Commission, and others from sectors such as mining that were excluded from the government's roundtable. I summarise what was discussed at Matt's roundtable later in this episode. Matt's roundtable was broadcast by Sky News, and if you want to watch it, you can find the link in the show notes. Please let me know if you have any questions about this episode or thoughts on what's covered. You can email me at contact@economicsexplored.com. And if you want to get some tasty coffee from the highlands of Peru, you should check out Lumo Coffee. Economics Explored listeners can get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. Righto, let's jump into it. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
As economist Judith Sloan wrote this week for The Australian, it started off as a productivity roundtable, then it became a reform roundtable, then it went back to being a productivity roundtable for a bit, but it ended up as an economic reform roundtable. It's hard to have confidence in our government when it can't even decide what to call its economic gabfest, let alone hope that anything actually productive or beneficial is going to come out of it. Maybe it was because they realised that if they called it a productivity roundtable, the people of Australia would be entitled to expect that something actually productive might come out of it. But how can it when the right people aren't even in the room? There were 23 core participants and around seven more joining in for bits of this three-day talkfest. But only six of those 30 people were what you would call business leaders. The rest were from government, from regulatory bodies, public servants, union leaders, advocacy groups, and expert advisors. How can you have a powerful and effective meeting about the economy and job creation and building Australia's business base and improving productivity with only half a dozen business people in the room? To take a look at what's been discussed and what's come out of the meeting, we've got our own roundtable on the roundtable. I'm joined by Other Side regulars, economist Gene Tunney, researcher and head of the Australian Institute for Progress think tank Graham Young, and former Bloomberg editor and data analyst Dan Petrie. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for joining us on the other side to discuss this exciting national event that we've had. And before we get into what you guys think came out of it or didn't come out of it, let's talk a little bit about what it actually was or what it was supposed to be, because it doesn't seem as though Albo and Chalmers were actually united just going into it on what it was supposed to be. Dan, any initial thoughts on that?
Well, the first thing that came out was, you know, there's the obvious things which you have to touch, which they didn't want to touch. GST was the first one when Albanese says it hurts the poor.
Yep.
And the moment you rule things in and out, and I think Chalmers wanted to be more open, that basically said to me, and just like, I'm sorry, but the participants who are there, the ACTU, I mean, asking the unions to advise on productivity is, you know, think of your favourite villain advising on the correct treatment of, you know, a maligned group. That's really what came out for me. This was a rehash of every productivity report and the bad ones, that is, that we've seen in the last couple of decades. And like, the ideas were rehashes, which...
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Jim Chalmers did a press conference, obviously, at the end of it on Thursday afternoon, and he sort of said, I'm going to list these 10 priority areas, and then I'm going to list these sort of quick wins we can have, but I'm not going to do anything with that. I don't want to offend any ministers, you know? And it was very, very... general. It sounded like he was repeating a lot of stuff.
Oh, I can tell you as a former journalist, and debatable how effective I was in that role, but the power of three. You say 10 commandments, you lose people.
Yeah, right? It's bad messaging.
So the first thing they try to talk about tax, but the fact that they've already decided, no, we're not doing anything. So it's basically like the Ken Henry moment. The second thing they decided to say was, we need to standardise licences across the nation. Okay, great. So that the tradie from Victoria can move up to Queensland.
Yep.
Like they're not already doing anyway. I mean, why would you hang around in Victoria? the third final thing was, you know, productivity. What is it? They can't even define what it is.
Yeah. No, they don't. Was it, Graham, your view, the wrong group of people around that table, or, you know, was it the wrong agenda, or was it worth doing?
So, round tables and summits are generally something a government does in its first term. So if you think about Bob Hawke, he had two, but it was basically to get the economy going after the Fraser period. So to put his prices and incomes accord into effect, and then they argued about indirect taxation, and he was actually ineffective on that. You had that huge one with Kevin Rudd, 1,000 people. Yeah. The fact that they're having this summit in their second term suggests that they don't have an agenda. The reason that they tend to have them in first terms is because, yeah, they want to set an agenda. They need a path forward. These guys don't have a path forward. In fact, the path forward in the case of Australia is the path backwards, because if you want to restore productivity, you need to fix the labour market. And in their first term, they bent the labour market.
Mm.
You need electricity prices. You need power prices to be low in their first term and continuing on in their second term. They're making them higher. So for me, looking at it, it was just a form of treading water while trying to kid the public that they were going forward.
Wouldn't we be right to expect that basically a government should know what's going to create productivity and pull the right levers and just do it?
Well, I mean, you know, you were talking.
Show some leadership.
They had the right people in the room. You've got the right people in the room here. And if you gave us 3 days, we'd come out with a program that would actually increase productivity, because it's pretty obvious what needs to be done in a lot of areas.
Yes.
At least in general, the specifics might take a bit to work out.
Yeah.
And there were issues they didn't discuss, like immigration. You know, that is a big drag on our productivity for reasons that might not be obvious, but... one thing is that the immigrants aren't necessarily high-value-add immigrants, so they're not in the highly productive part of the economy, but they're also diverting resources away from the highly productive part of the economy. You know, if you took the mining industry out of the Australian economy, our productivity would be a lot less than it is now, a lot worse. They're about 50% of any increase that we've had, and that's because they're an industry that uses huge amounts of capital. So they can pay people really well.
Yeah.
The immigration that we're bringing in is diverting from mining, and it's bringing in the sort of labour that doesn't work that sort of capital equipment.
Well, you're not allowed to talk about immigration in Australia, although if you're a neo-Nazi immediately, there's no spectrum of views on that. It's just you're either all for immigration or you're a neo-Nazi. I think we're going to see that play out, certainly seeing it playing out online in the debate around this August 31 proposed rallies and things that are maybe going to happen. Gene Tunney, you're the economist in the room. Basic economics question for you. Productivity is important because it represents the real creation of value in our economy. It's the real, you can print all the money you like, you can move money around, you can change all the rules, but if we're not making stuff, doing stuff, building stuff, creating stuff, and we have low productivity, we can't have nice things no matter what you do with wages, because if you put wages up, there's no productivity, then your real wages are going down in actuality because inflation will occur, right?
Well, yes. I mean, we end up with inflation. This is the concern of the Reserve Bank. You may have heard Michelle Bullock last week after the interest rate decision, and I think that shocked a lot of people, where she was saying we have to revise down our projected productivity growth rate for Australia, so how much more productive we get each year. And what that means is that the sustainable rate of growth, the speed limit that they talk about before we get inflation, that's lower. So,
did she put a number on it?
She did, but
the Productivity Commission, I think, put it at about 0.7.
Something along those lines. Yeah. So, whereas when in the early 2000s, we were assuming in Treasury that productivity was running at 1.75% per annum. Well, then we kept having to revise it down in each of the intergenerational reports. Gosh. So I remember when I was there, we revised it down to 1.5 or something, but now it's much lower than that.
How does that compare with world standards?
Well, we've had this issue in other advanced economies too, but it's not just us. But I mean, other advanced economies have similar issues with overregulation and large public sectors. So we probably don't necessarily want to compare ourselves, say, with those other sclerotic European economies and say, oh, everything's fine. I think we can do a lot better than that. But we've really got to address the heavy role of government in the economy. My colleague at Centre for Independent Studies, Robert Carling, had a real banger of a report a couple of weeks ago on Leviathan on the Rampage. We're up at 39% of GDP, government spending to GDP. And I mean, we had a bit higher in COVID because of all the JobKeeper, but this is a record in the post-war period otherwise. And nearly half or over half of people, according to Robert's estimates, are getting their main income from the government. Right? So that's just terrible for productivity.
That's terrifying. That's a terrifying statistic. That scared me more than anything. It was that CIS report from Sydney, right?
Yes.
That more than half of Australians are getting their income from the government in some way, shape, or form. Our public service, now, noticeably, there was not a lot of conversation about cutting the size of the public service or reducing the size of government. In fact, we seem to have gone back to we're stuck with this philosophy in the country of government can and should fix everything.
The other thing too, which this was not an issue at the election, and this is also not an issue, in the last few years, but we've stopped talking about small business as a jobs generator. That to me is frightening. So the idea of risking your own capital, which should be the fundamental aim for many, to risk your own capital, to have a go in the economy, the fair go, that no longer exists. It's basically the risk is, why do that when I can go and turn up and work in government where the average wage, we're coming here from Queensland, is in excess of $100,000. That's across the public service. But the broader point being is that you have all these people clustering around your capital cities, along the East Coast. Australia's not, for example, doesn't suffer from a shortage of land. It actually doesn't even suffer from a shortage of regional centres. But the fact of the matter is, when government is, the big honeypot, people are going to cluster around there. And that's why, items such as tent cities and these, the visage of, a cost of living crisis is, when it's the only game in town, if that's all you can do is work for government in whatever role it is, and that's not taking away from the important role of essential workers.
Yeah.
But the reality is the bureaucracy, it's a problem. I remember putting freedom of information requests in. What type of roles are there? And Graham raised the point about mining before. I mean, it is one of the fundamental sectors which pays its own way. And we find amazing ways to really hamstring that industry. So the broader point being is, we talk about people earning their living from government. What's also concerning is the number of bankruptcies in the small business sector, because it's too hard to get ahead. And why is it hard to get ahead in the private sector? Because of energy costs.
Well, looking at the 10 things, I mean, there are two lists of 10 things. There's sort of a list of general ideas and a list that they're going to follow up. And he was at pains not to upset any ministers. It was kind of like, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to respect the ministers and talk to the ministers. And then there's a list of 10 things he thinks we can do pretty quickly and tick off. And I can't see anything here. I mean, there's general thematic talk about better regulation, tightening regulation, reducing red tape.
But this is classic Chalmers. I'm sorry to jump in, but he sounds great. He sounds so convincing, but the truth of the matter is he never
talks. I don't think he does.
But the thing is, he talks in generality.
And waffle.
Mm. There's nothing specific about it. You know, like, I mean, you can get up and say, we're going to do this and use the big words. But unless someone can actually hang on to what is actually going to change.
Well, he tries to be specific and says, we're going to do these 10 things straight away. And then it's still generalities. Like, there's still nothing on this list that I can say, okay, you know, simplifying trade, having a tell us once regulation amendment to. It's all about changing government systems, Jim's, processes. Nothing for small business, Dan. That's to your point.
So, Jim's general 10 thematics. That's the up.
Well, it's 10 thematics and then 10 specifics that sound like thematics. Yeah, anyway, well, Graham.
he's Dr. Jim Chalmers, and that's how you get a PhD. Voluminous writing, has very little impact on anyone, and gets tucked away in the Fryer Library, University of Queensland, for the rest of your life, and no one looks at it again.
And now he's the Treasurer of Australia.
So an interesting thing about size of government is, at the same time you've got the round table going on, you've got the Commonwealth Bank, I think it was, talking about AI and how it's using it to reduce its workforce. They had a bit of a stoush with the union over it. AI was kind of vaguely discussed at this meeting. The unions were concerned that AI not destroy anyone's job and that they actually get the benefit of the AI. But we are moving into a world where we're going to need fewer and fewer people to do these sort of administrative things.
Because
one thing AI is very good at is form filling. You know, I got to do my SMSF investment principles the other day. I just told it what I was doing and why I was doing this. And 10 seconds later, it gave me a perfectly acceptable sheet, which I can give to the auditor.
So there's
a whole public servant that could be gone, probably blanks of public servants that could be gone.
But what are they going to do? Because we don't have that small business mentality, that innovation mentality that, you know, this is the
problem. Bump up the vet sector and retrain them to drive dump trucks in central Queensland.
Yeah.
But make more money.
And we're talking about the bureaucrat public servants, not the frontline public servants, by the way, not the cops and the teachers and the help bulb.
And none of whom are employed by the federal government anyway.
That's right.
That was another thing lacking. The state governments weren't there.
Mm,
and a lot of this service delivery, a lot of the productivity actually happens at the state government level.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a really bizarre thing, wasn't it? It's very strange, and it's a little surprise that not much has come out of it. And they've almost tried to perhaps kill it from a public relations point of view.
Well, potentially there are some interesting tax measures coming out of it. So we have to see what Chalmers develops, and he may have a conflict with Albanese. I mean, Chalmers is certainly trying to position himself as the next PM.
Yeah, it feels like there's a conflict going on already.
Yes. Yep. And so, I mean, this, you know, Chalmers could have an opportunity to be, you know, do something like Paul Keating and develop a significant tax package, but we have to wait and see just how much courage he has. But apparently there are a lot of potentially controversial ideas raised in that room. Chris Richardson did a really interesting LinkedIn post last night where he's saying anyone in that room in the tax discussion that Chris was part of could generate three banner headlines that could kill off any tax reform coming out of the summit because the ideas were that controversial. And he's saying, well, I'm not going to reveal anything because I think the situation's very fragile, right?
So we don't know what those three
banner headlines are. No, he won't tell us. But I think we could imagine. I mean, it'll be things around superannuation, tax GST. Concessions. I think they've been suggesting they'll do something with an EV tax. To have EV drivers. I don't think they'll touch GST. They might tighten up negative gearing, that sort of thing. I think they'll be looking along those lines.
All right, we'll hold that thought. We're going to come back and talk about taxation a little bit later on, but we'll take a quick break and we'll come back with our round table on the round table here on the other side.
This is The Other Side.
Paul Kelly wrote in The Australian this week that Australia now lives in a Labor ascendancy that will run at least until the early 2030s. And it's a time which we'll see economic policy completely re-engineered. Evolutionary change is coming, he says. and that this will be driven by modern Labor's values and what it thinks it can actually achieve politically in real terms, which, given its huge majority in the parliament and control of the Senate with the Greens, would be probably a heck of a lot right now. Kelly says that while it's still a work in progress, the main elements of Labor's agenda seem to be as follows. A complete rejection of any industrial relations deregulation, so no freeing up things for business owners and bosses in the workplace. Little interest in any public sector spending restraint, so no government tightening its belt at all. So more tax will be needed as a result of that to address a decade of fiscal deficits. A more government-directed industry policy and a renewed emphasis on workforce skills. Greater interventions by the state in the economy. So more socialism and less liberalism. You can forget about a more free and market forces-led economy. And enshrining the renewable energy transition as pivotal in reviving economic growth and productivity, not just a part of the mix, but pivotal to growth. There have been some very dumb ideas already floated at the Labor Government's Economics Roundtable, previously known as the Productivity Roundtable. To take a look at some of them, we've got our own roundtable on the roundtable happening this week on the other side, and I'm joined by other side regulars, former Bloomberg editor and data analyst Dan Petrie, head of the Australia Institute for Progress think tank Graham Young, and economist Gene Tunney. Gentlemen, welcome back. Paul Kelly says evolutionary change is coming, and Labor will be running things well into 2030. So, this is a classical liberal economist's worst nightmare, isn't it, Graham?
I wouldn't have called it evolution.
So devolution?
Well, what we need is more devolution in the economy so that people who are close to the decisions that need to be made actually make them and are allowed to get on with things. So no, it won't be that either. It's reversion. I mean, all those things, if they're Labor values, they're like, remember that Sally Robbins, I think it was, who lay down in the middle of the Olympics and the racing team? That's what this government is. They're laying down. There is not a single thing there that I'd call a value. It's just laziness.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to change a single thing. We don't want to work harder.
Okay. If you were running the show, Gene Tunney, what would be your top three things to get productivity going in Australia right away?
Well, certainly,
I'll put you on the spot.
Yes. I mean, this is why I'll never be elected, but we need to really significantly cut spending. We've got too many resources going into the government sector, into less productive activities, and that's increasing the tax burden on the rest of us. So we really need to get spending under control, cut taxes to incentivize work effort and incentivize investment. Secondly, we need to sort out the energy problem that we've got. This was one of the themes, and not to necessarily politically endorse one side or the other. I was invited to Matt Canavan's roundtable, which was held on the Wednesday in the room above where the secret productivity roundtable was being held in the cabinet room below. And Matt invited people from the resources sector, from mining, from industry. And I was invited along with Gary Banks, David Pearl, a former assistant treasurer, Gary Banks, former head of the Productivity Commission. And there was general agreement that the big problems we've got are excessive government spending and very high energy costs. We see how much energy costs have spiked since we started this rollout of renewables without a balanced energy plan. So essentially, we're going heavy on renewables when we have to have all of the additional storage. We need to rely more on gas to balance supply and demand at times when there's not enough energy. And we end up with these, very high prices in wholesale market, which translated to higher retail prices. Yeah, so we've had this big shock, which is affecting consumers and it's affecting industry. So we've got all of these refiners and smelters, which are now needing bailouts from the government. We've got BHP and we've got, big companies like that saying that they may have to cut jobs in Australia just because we're such a high-cost jurisdiction. So we've really got to fix energy, and it's having a more balanced policy. It's removing the ban on nuclear power so we can, potentially have that as part of the mix. And it's about dialing down the commitment to this, very strong, very fast rollout of renewables, which is just driving up costs and, costing consumers and business.
Okay. And I couldn't agree more on all of that. And I think it's critical and important, and we've got to get onto it fast. Instead, what we have is this: the Productivity Commission itself, with its investing in cheaper, cleaner energy and the net zero transition report. you know, proposing a classification of all 11 million homes in Australia according to their climate resilience. I mean, why are we getting stuff like this coming out of a productivity commission, you know, let alone a productivity roundtable of mostly left-wing thinkers?
The headline's wrong. I mean, investing in cheaper electricity.
Yeah.
The prices are there. The input costs are incredibly high. Gene's point is the right one, and Graham's also touched on it as well. You know, like that cost input you've got being burdened by the private sector. The spending capacity, you know, basically being this crowding out everything else is the government. And I go back to, again, my favourite talking point, the small business, like that ability to innovate, you know, this productivity roundtable seems to have left out the one thematic which didn't make the cut, innovation. And then they want to try and regulate that too with their AI and all these things. The bottom line is really about this roundtable, which we saw during the week, was a rehash, no new ideas, more regulation. And the simple fact is that critical area, the magic ingredient of any economy, the one that's going to prosper is the one that's going to be more efficient, come up with better innovation, it's an afterthought. And this idea of energy in terms of, I don't want to be critical of Mr. Bowen, the energy minister at the national level, but I have to be. I mean, this is almost like a crusade in terms of renewables good, anything else in the mix is bad. It's a terrible headline to continually spit out because it's just not borne out in fact. And, you know, if you look at Australia, I mean, I lived in Hong Kong and, you know, all over. And I mean, it is a very tough place now to extract a dollar, you know. And when, you know, when the aspiration is, you know, if you look at some of the advocacy groups is to tax, 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 what do you want to be like France where, you know, like be the top of the scale? We're not competitive and we've got problems and we don't really want to talk about it at a microeconomic level. We have these 11 million homes in the macro thematic. Again, it's the thematic. The hard work at the community level is always the toughest bit. The end.
Yeah. It's just extraordinary to me. I mean, I can't understand how we can put small business down, how we can have no focus on innovation. We can have high energy costs. And we think this is a productivity summit. Matt Canavan, I thought, had a great line on this. He was talking about, you know, we've gone from some of the cheapest energy prices in the world to the highest energy prices in the world. And that is fundamental to sorting out this productivity decline. And he said, you've got, you know, people with economic degrees sitting around this table who've somehow just forgotten how critical low energy prices are to productivity and to economic growth, Graham.
Yeah, well, there's a straight line relationship, I like to say, between energy consumption and civilization. But that same straight line exists with productivity. You know, we only have the society we live in today with all the wealth that we've got, so that, you know, four of us have got time even to sit around a table talking to you, is because we've worked out how to harness the universe to our benefit. And if you increase the cost of that input, it's like increasing the cost of any other input. It decreases your output per unit, which is, and productivity. You know, someone said to me, I don't think the average punter knows what productivity is. And the government has tried to redefine it as or doing things better or whatever, but it's basically doing more with less.
Yeah.
So if the cost of less goes up, then you're trying to do more, but with more, and that doesn't work.
Mm. No. We've got the ACTU in the room talking. I mean, we've talked about the four-day work week last week. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Only in Australia could you come up with, one way to increase productivity would be to drop to, you know, the working hours from 30. It's not about the days, but they talk about 38 to 30. The hours a week. That's the problem. Doesn't matter how many days you do.
I've got to give my zinger line. You know, the ACTU, you know, have done more for productivity, you know, than what Jack the Ripper did for late night shopping. I mean, these are thought bubbles. They have no, you know, basis in fact. In fact, you know, the union movement have next to zero representation in the private sector, you know, in most industries.
It's
completely absurd.
It is.
They're offering their hot take on, you know.
It's incredible. And they're not a balanced union organisation anyway. You can see they're quite ideologically radical. The 4-day work week was one thing, but this idea that they start talking about AI and suggesting that you know, the workers should be the ones to determine the rollout of AI in the workplace. Well, technology is not going to take a back seat to the preferences of Sally McManus and the ACTU. Well, it might. The world's not going to either.
It might do, and the world might not either, but countries have managed to do those sorts of things, and that is the recipe for deteriorating living standards with respect to the rest of the world. I mean, one of the things that sort of struck me about the whole thing is, and it's been brought back today by the Chinese comments about Taiwan, is that we're living potentially in the shadow of another war. President Xi has said 2027, he wants to have Taiwan taken back. The Americans have basically said, no, you're not. We've got all these bases on Australia. Now, war is basically economies by other means. And if you've got a weak economy, and that's where we're heading, you are vulnerable. And that wasn't any part of the discussion. You know, we're all carrying on as though life is just a series of parties smoking pot on the beach at Byron Bay. And mum and dad will come along and clean up afterwards. Mm. And so, you know, what we've got here will just keep itself.
You bloody boomer. You can't talk like that, you boomer. God forbid.
Oh, you're going to call me a warmonger.
It's bad enough with the avocado and the cafe lattes, mate.
Can I just say one thing on the AI? Can you imagine Sam Altman, who, you know, basically led the ChatGPT in the collective consciousness as we now know it? I mean, could you imagine these guys, you know, just looking at this round table going, you know what? They would have shrugged their shoulders and went, Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
just Australia. Yeah, yeah. They would have gone, Australia. Yeah. Yeah. The Pacific's version of Canada. That's really what they would have said. You know, like this nonsense that, like, you've got these, for a while there, the financial markets thought, you know what? We're going to sort these cryptocurrencies out. Guess what? The world moves on. Technologies, yeah, regulation is going to find it very, very tough to keep up.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. 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 All right. Okay. So productivity and AI, NDIS controls were the other thing. Now, look, the NDIS, something's got to be done about the NDIS because it's just blowing out. We can't have, you know, it would be lovely if we could support everybody all the time for everything. But there has to be a line drawn somewhere with the NDIS or it's going to collapse, right? And they've decided to draw the line around this spike in everybody saying it's, you know, the and there is a lot of autism out there. I'm not diminishing that at any point, but the reality is that the NDIS is supposed to be for more serious disability, not moderate disability so much.
So they're removing it from the NDIS spectrum, so to speak.
Yes. They are moving it, though, to a new program that's going to cost $2 billion federally and for which they're going to ask the states for a few to chip in for a few billion, I think. But any thoughts on how we manage health and disability services moving forward, well, guys, that in a way that's sustainable, it isn't going to send us broke.
There's a fundamental philosophical problem here in that they think that benefits ought to be universal. Now, Labor is in a better position to deal with these sorts of issues than the coalition. And the history of Australia is that it's Labor that's actually put the brakes on welfare programs in the past. Why should the NDIS be available to everyone, irrespective of income? You know, if Gina Reinhart had an autistic child, why should she be able to get money off the NDIS? And I'm just taking Gina as an extreme example that the left like to throw in people's faces. So, you know, just means testing it. The whole idea that somehow we're born into life and we get to keep all the goodies and the government underwrites all the baddies and ensures that everyone has exactly the same standard of living is just nonsensical. And people like Paul Keating understood that.
Mm.
They understood that these programs end up eating a whole lot of other things that are required for people who are also unfortunate or fallen off the wagon.
Of course, there's only so much to go around in terms of what we can tax people and you put into the public purse. But people aren't thinking that way. We're not educating Australians to think that way.
Well, the problem is that people, voters, have got used to, and I think this is possibly a COVID effect, the idea that government will step in. If there's anything bad there, they will step in and they'll fix it for you.
Yeah.
You know, they're the ones that ought to be responsible rather than saying, look, can you say shit happens on this program?
You can.
Shit happens. And you want a resilient economy so that people got their own resources
yes.
to deal with it.
You also want resilient people, and you don't build resilient people in a resilient by suppressing innovation, by killing small business and people who want to get out and have a go, by making it incredibly difficult for people to have a go, and by creating a general cultural mood of A, victimhood, and B, a sense of oppression by some mean oppressor, when it's not really happening either, to get a little bit philosophical about it for a second. Gene Tunney, you know, your comment on this NDIS situation, or just in terms of our social services?
Well, they certainly need to do something. So it's good in a way that they're addressing it. There are concerns about how they've gone about it. They haven't consulted properly with advocacy groups, with families. So I think there are concerns around that. I've got to declare a conflict of interest here. I'm on the board of a nonprofit that advocates for families with children with a developmental delay. And the concerns from the sector are that this has just been announced suddenly. There's been no proper consultation. So I think it's bad in that regard. But look, I mean, credit to the government. They need to address the cost of NDIS. It's been growing at 20% per year. Okay. So it's doubling in size over 3 years. Okay. And their target is to get it down to 8%, right? Which is still faster than the economy grows about 5% or something in nominal terms. So it's still going to be growing as a share of the budget, as a share of the economy. So even their target for what they'd be happy to get it down to is still too high. So that they really do need to do something. I'm concerned about the way they've got here and how they're going to push all these costs onto the states. So this is about cost shifting to the states. It's about getting children onto what they call foundational supports. And they haven't really dealt the states into it. Graham's point before, we haven't got the state treasurers there. Mookie's there, Daniel Mookie, who seems very good from New South Wales, but he's just one state. They really need to talk to all the states about this.
Somebody on Twitter was saying yesterday that, you know, we should really be looking at just cleaning up the ripoffs, the scams, and the way people are taking the mickey out of the NDIS. But do you think there is a lot of that going on?
Yes.
Okay. So but if we clean that up, would that bring it down and not enough?
No.
You still have to draw a line.
Well, we're spending, 46 to 48 billion this financial year or something of that magnitude. It's around 50 billion, so $50,000 million on the NDIS. I mean, I've no doubt there's rorting, and it's probably billions of dollars of rorting, but still the fundamental problem is just the high rate of eligibility. And I mean, what Graham's talking about with potentially means testing. I mean, maybe we should be looking at something like that. It's the parameters of the scheme. It's not just rorting. Rorting's part of it, but we're still not going to solve the problem with cracking down on rorting.
Yeah. All right, we'll come back in a moment and we'll talk tax with our roundtable on the roundtable here on the other side. The head of Australia's peak union body, the ACTU secretary, Sally McManus, wants higher property taxes, higher taxes on resources. She wants higher taxes on family trusts. And of course, more tax on what she calls wealthy Australians. And she doesn't think workers will be better off if there's lower taxes, nor does she think there's anything wrong with current levels of government spending, despite the fact that we have government debt across federal and state of around $1.5 million. That's $1.5 trillion. Annual interest on that, by the way, at 5%, works out to $75,000 million or $75 billion. That's about $3,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country, and about $6,000 for every taxpayer. That's wasted every year on interest payments, not new government spending, just completely lost. It's interest on debt, on money already spent. And they keep spending more than they're bringing in, so the debt keeps increasing. The young will pay all of this more than the old will, but the young keep voting for the left. Go figure. It's hilarious. Anyway, the final day of the Albanese government's economic summit focused on the question of taxation. And the ACTU says it wants Aussies to pay $25,000 million more in tax every year. And please stop with the, oh, we just want the rich to pay and the corporations to pay. At the end of the day, you want to shift $25 billion a year from the private productive economy to the public consuming economy mainly, by force. And everyone who works is productive is therefore paying, if not directly, then indirectly in everything we buy and do. Sally McManus says, quote, "We actually want our healthcare system and our education system properly funded. We actually value all of those things," unquote. as if everybody else doesn't, as if you don't follow her line of thinking and the socialist strategy, you don't care about those things. We all value those things, Sally. I hate to break it to you. The only difference between the left and the right is that the right realize that just giving government more money doesn't mean the services are going to get delivered better. We believe the better way to deliver services to people is in a competitive market, not a monopoly run by a few elite bureaucrats and left-wing politicians who are only accountable to the public once every 3 to 4 years. We think the government could be delivering a hell of a lot more social service for the tax we're already paying if they'd let the private sector do more of the delivery competitively and fund the customers, letting the users choose the best providers. But anyway, that's not how the left thinks. They just want to keep taxing productive Aussies who have to compete to earn a buck in the real world, force them to hand over half their earnings in tax, and then distribute it to the people that they like to run all the services in a monopolized government system. I'm simplifying and exaggerating and generalizing, but that's basically what it is. And that's called socialism. And Sally probably missed the 20th century where we learned quite clearly it doesn't work. So the final day of the Albanese economic roundtable thingy, or the Chalmers economic roundtable thingy, Albo or Jimbo, take your pick. We're focused on taxation. We've got our own roundtable on the roundtable here on the other side. I'm joined by our regulars, head of the Australian Institute for Progress think tank, Graham Young, former Bloomberg editor and data analyst, Dan Petrie, and economist, Gene Tunney. Gentlemen, can we pay any more tax? I'll start with you this time, Gene. $25 billion more Sally McManus wants us to pay. Can we afford it?
It's a choice we have to make. I mean, my choice is no, and I think it'd be bad for our productivity, our efficiency. It'd dull incentives to work, incentives to save and invest. So I'm certainly not for it. Can we actually pay more tax? I mean, sure, there are countries that have higher tax burdens than Australia. There's no doubt about that they could actually increase taxation. But I don't think that's desirable from an economic or an equity perspective, because, I mean, we're basically, if you look at us, how, you know, most of the tax is disproportionately levied on, you know, a small section of the population, and the private sector tends to bear a lot of it. And I mean, small business people are really just being ground down by the heavy taxation burden. So as a, you know, business person myself, I'm certainly not in favour of more tax. I'd like to see, you know, cuts to tax rates and, you know, really incentivise that entrepreneurship and work effort.
Okay. Graham?
Yeah, we can obviously pay more tax. Should we pay more tax? That's the question. But we're going to be forced to pay more tax because government spending, as federal government spending, is in the papers given to the round table, going to hit 27%. Of GDP. Now, I remember back to the 70s when it was 17% of GDP, and shock horror, Gough Whitlam nudged it up by about 3 percentage points. I think we got to about 22, and then it stayed there for 40 or so years.
So 27% of GDP, and that's just federal government spending.
That's just federal government spending. I think someone quoted 39% as being total government spending in the country, which is getting scarily close to 50%. So the government has to get its spending under control. That's sort of number one, so that you can sort the tax situation out. There's a myth that we're a low tax country. We're not. We're in the middle for the OECD, depending how you deal with the superannuation. So a lot of the OECD countries, they charge a social security welfare insurance, which is part of your taxation. We basically have ours as a privatised sort of system where we have 12.5% effectively taken out of our pay by the boss and invested somewhere. That actually shows you what productivity can do, because the OECD countries that have these insurance policies, basically it's kind of unfunded. They're going to go broke, whereas here we're complaining that people have got too much money in their social security account. Because when you're managing it yourself and when you're letting the private sector manage it, you actually do a better job than just letting the government.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a good example. So that's a sort of tax situation which is to our benefit. But when you compare us to other countries in the OECD, the only area where we're kind of out of whack is indirect taxation. So the only room, if they want to be competitive, for them to really change anything much is with indirect tax. And I think that's why you saw them playing around, although they ran away from it, with a carbon tax, Because if you think about it, it's a GST, but specific to things that emit CO2.
Yeah.
They could have played around with tariffs.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And
well, I'm looking at the 10 things and then the other 10 immediate things that Jim Chalmers spoke about in his media statement after his speech after the roundtable. And I can't see anything concrete there that we can talk about in terms of tax policy. But the Council of Small Business Organisations Australia Chairman Matthew Addison was reported as having said that in the meeting when they were talking about tax, many people, including the business groups, suggested reforms to the GST could be considered. No doubt putting up the GST to something like 15% or 12.5% or something. Why would that be a good idea or not, Dan, do you think?
Well, it's the only way. You have to drag down the income tax, the corporate tax burden. I mean, the idea, really, if you were to say to Australians, do you know what? You spend the first 4 months of the year paying tax. They go, what? Yeah, you do. 4 months of the year. Then so the reality is we're not competitive. That's the truth of it. You know, and eventually you start to get a trickle. People look offshore and that's
it. Can I just say, I think we spend the first 6 months of the year. I mean, if you look at our taxation levels, you know, what they are as income tax, but then you add all of the taxes that we pay in terms of, you know, all the after-tax tax, like you can't even drive down the road.
No.
You know, you're paying for that. You're paying for everything on top of everything again.
Do you know what? Tax in this country—
it's got to be above 50%.
As a topic, tax in this country, reform of the taxation system in this country should be lumped in with the very fast train proposal.
It's never going to—
And it's just, I mean, and it's so sad because the truth of the matter is, you know, that we talk about, you know, getting the country going on the innovation side, but if you're a small business again starting out, you are, truthfully, you are smashed when you know, in terms of you have to get an accountant, you have to set up company structures, you have to sink all this capital before you can even turn a dollar. You then have to pay very high input prices. You then have to deal with an industrial relations framework which says, like, I want to employ, you know, Mary Jo on Sunday, and the idea of serving cappuccinos at $42 an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, you start to get into this realm where going, well, why should I pay $42 an hour? Because her income tax is incredibly high.
Yeah.
Whereas if we would actually have a very honest conversation about it, that the impost on the person risking their own capital, you know, if the headline rate's 25-27%, you can go offshore and you can start a business where the headline rate is a lot lower.
Well, like, I've had a number of people tell me they want to go offshore lately.
Well, you know, and I mean, but when people start mumbling about it, starts reflecting in other areas where capital goes to flight. That's all.
Yeah. So GST, Gene, do you think that they will touch GST or that won't be in the mix?
They won't touch GST. They see the proposed changes to GST as regressive. I think Albanese would push back on that.
Inflationary, probably.
Well, there'll be an initial hit to prices and that'll be picked up in CPI, but the RBA will look through it. I mean, that happened in 2000 when we introduced GST. Yeah. But look, I don't think they'll do it. It just creates so much political pain for them, particularly if you wanted to bring in fresh food and education and health. I mean, could you imagine the political risks?
Yeah. What's more likely, though, raising the company tax, which of course we all pay. I mean,
for the big companies,
yeah. So and having this two double taxation or something, you know, companies over with a turnover of more than $1 billion will pay more. What do you think of that?
I like the idea of a cash flow tax, but I think it should be across the board. I'm not a great fan of having, you know, this hybrid system. This it's really clumsy. Judith Sloan just shredded it in The Australian a few weeks ago. The PC were constrained by the fact that it had to be revenue neutral, that the government basically told them, look, we don't want to lose money on this. So you've got to, if you want to cut tax on small business, on smaller companies, then you need to make it up somehow. So they introduce this additional cash flow tax. So I'd be worried about introducing a new tax while you've still got an old tax. I think it's a risk in terms of, you know, they could potentially just have, you know, more tax in the future. So I'd like them to, you know, come up with a proper company tax system, maybe based on a cash flow tax, rather than have this hybrid system that they've developed.
Is there any case for suggesting that lowering tax might actually, you know, Laffer curve theory sort of stuff? But I mean, is it possible that lowering tax could actually help?
You want to lower tax at least on investment activities. And companies exist for only one purpose, to do business. And
So to be clear, that taxing wealth, when we tax wealth,
that's right,
we're taxing investment activity.
That's right. There's a view on the left that people are like Scrooge McDuck. And when they get wealthy, they just put it in a barn somewhere. And then on Sundays, they go and look at it.
Yeah. That's basically how most Aussies think. That's not how it works. Sorry.
It actually gets invested into businesses in some way, shape or form that can pay a return. And it seeks the highest return. And, you know, Australia has got a hollowed out economy.
It really does.
We're very good at producing mineral wealth. That mineral wealth, particularly the iron ore, is at the top of a cycle. And there's every chance it's going to disappear, which is going to make the tax funding position perilous. So we need other things in there. We're good at health, at medical innovation. But why would you come here and set up a health company that, you know, your hope's going to be what they call a unicorn, you know, list at $1 billion with our capital gains tax potentially going up rather than down? You know, you want to encourage that sort of activity.
I can't see why anybody would want to invest here at the moment. I love this. The Grattan Institute chief executive, Aruna Santhanapali, I'm sorry if I pronounce that wrong, but in her presentation to the roundtable, she pushed for tax changes to the wealthy and retirees to fix intergenerational inequity, suggesting a dual income tax system where wages are taxed differently from capital. She said a higher GST could help states phase out inefficient taxes and said a land tax would be worthwhile. I mean, you know, there were hardly any people, experts on taxation in that tax discussion that had a sort of liberal or classical liberal or free market perspective on anything. We are running out of time, guys. So quick 30-second wrap-up from each of you. Dan, any thoughts on?
Well, I thought it was a waste of time. And eventually, if you don't reform, if you stand in the middle of the road, eventually you get run over. That was what Thatcher said.
Yeah.
That's where we're at the moment. It's an incredibly uninspiring roundtable full, sadly, of the same characters.
Graham?
We've got a government with no direction, which I think contradicts Paul Kelly's position that they'll be in power to 2030, because if you don't have direction, you don't have momentum, and if you don't have momentum, then you're vulnerable.
So even with the majority of 93 seats in the House, in the lower House, you think they could lose the next election?
They could.
Yep.
Not predicting it, but they could.
Thank you, Graham. Gene?
There was one thing we didn't mention, which is the fact that at least they've seen the light on the need to reduce regulation on new projects. They've come to it through the need to have more renewables, which is not necessarily what we need at the moment. We need to have a balanced approach to new energy, but they've been inspired by that Ezra Klein book, Abundance, in the US, which is very popular in progressive circles. So they've come to it from not the same way I would have come to it, but I think it's good that they're focused on removing regulation. But we've heard talk about reducing red tape and green tape, et cetera, before. We have to see how that all plays out. So that's a tick. I want to see how Chalmers develops this tax package. Is it going to be a big reform? Is he going to try to position himself to be PM? And is he going to really try and do some radical things there? That's what I think is going to be really interesting over the coming years.
It's going to be an interesting thing to watch in the next sort of 2 or 3 months to see it. The aftermath of the roundtable and what plays out and comes out of it. So anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you giving up your time for us this week. And we look forward to seeing you all again on the show in the future.
Thanks, Damien.
Thanks.